Episode 60, Patrick and Cyprian speak with Philip Murphy, CEO of Cornelis Networks. The team discuss AI, large language models, optimization problems, and the connections to quantum computing. Welcome to Entangled Things, your quantum computing podcast, hosted by Patrick and Cyprian.
Hey, Cyprian, how you doing?
Hey, Patrick, doing well. Looking forward for another great Entangled Things episode.
So am I. And we're joined by Phil. Phil, do you mind introducing yourself to our audience?
Yeah. No, my name is Phil Murphy. I'm the CEO of Cornelis Networks. It's a company that's focused on high performance interconnect supporting, I think we all agree is a really exciting time in AI and HPC.
So you guys, quantum's part of what you do as well, but it's high performance computing, and that's definitely down Cyprian's alley. Is there anything that has caught your eye in the recent news, maybe news that you're even making yourself, that we should be talking about?
Yeah, no, I think, we're kind of in an amazing time right now. I think AI is really just beginning to make a huge impact on many areas of human endeavor, no doubt about it in my mind. What's really happening now is that a lot of folks are, finally becoming aware of some of the great breakthroughs, kind of enabled by things like ChatGPT, right? Yep. GPT-3, GPT-4. There's a lot of others, image generation as well. Things like, DALL-E 2, Stable Diffusion, Midjourney, things like that. But yeah, honestly, this is really just the tip of the iceberg about what's really going on here in AI. The progress that we're seeing today really is enabled by three things that have come together, recently. We've got these innovative algorithms, and I'm sure you guys are following all the, kind of key players in that space. OpenAI, of course, is the one on the tip of everybody's tongue, but we have Anthropic, Google DeepMind, Google Brain AI, Meta AI, several others, Numenta. These are all guys that are taking, slightly different approaches on how to approach the problem, and making tremendous strides. So we need algorithms, right? And I mean, the fundamental algorithm has existed since the 1950s, but the amazing, improvements now that we're seeing are just driving, fantastic progress.
We finally figured out how to use that alien technology. Is that what it is?
Exactly. It's quite amazing. And then, the second thing that we needed was we needed data. And so, thankfully, our civilization lived through the internet era, right? Over the last 20, 25 years. And, one of the side effects of the internet era was just a collection of a huge amount of data, things like, Wikipedia, but many, many other, websites and others, just collected a ton of data. And so the data was the second thing that was necessary to go along with the algorithms, because the algorithms need to be trained by data. But the third part of this is computational power, okay? And it just takes an enormous amount of compute power to be able to train these models. And we just didn't have that before, right? So even with the data and even with the algorithms, you still needed the computation. But more recently, right, that's been starting to become solved as well. The kind of unit of computation in our world today is the GPU. This is a technology that's been evolved. It came out of the graphics world, of course, but now is used for more general purpose computing and really specifically in the AI and HPC world. And so, that's great, right? A fantastic advance. However, no single GPU can do the job by itself. Okay.
Yeah.
You need to be able to harness the aggregate power of hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of GPUs to be working on the same problem at the same time. And this is an enormous problem to coordinate the activity of all these different cores that are running the algorithms. They have to be able to be kept in lockstep, in sync, to make sure that they're working on the problem together. And they also have to be able to share enormous amounts of data. Okay. And so that's where.
I'm sorry. Are you talking about something where they're all working in the same system, same data center, or something like open SETI online where you're stealing resources, you're stealing compute power from across the globe in a distributed way? or is it both?
I'm actually talking about the former, which means that they're all working in the data center at the same time. To be able to train some of these large language models, or image generation technologies and things that are becoming in the future, the characteristics of the interconnect that you're using are incredibly important, right? You have to be able to, on a very, very fine-grained time scale, be able to coordinate the activities of all the cores that are working together. And so, the latency is, measured in nanoseconds, not in milliseconds, okay? Because, what's going on here is, you're putting these, expensive and increasingly expensive, I should say, pieces of computational hardware, things like GPUs are, they're doing a great job, but they are getting more and more complex. And there are other potential solutions to that, some startups are working on to have, purpose-built accelerators to be able to improve AI. And they haven't really broken through totally yet, but there's many different ways. But the point is that no matter what piece of hardware you put out there to start to train these gigantic models, no one piece can do it by itself, and they have to aggregate many of them. And so you can think of this as almost a warehouse full of computational equipment that is used to then train one of these systems. And so that's where our company comes in. Okay, our company. Cornelis Networks, it's focused on delivering very high performance interconnects. People are usually familiar with technologies like Ethernet, right? That's been in the data center for many years, has a long legacy history. It's going all the way back to the 70s, actually, with people like Bob Metcalf who started it. Mm-hmm. It's evolved over many years, and there's a compatibility that people like to have with Ethernet, but there's also the requirement to be as efficient as possible, because if you imagine something like at least there's a rumor that GPT-5 is in the middle of being trained right now, and it just got started. It's rumored to be completing in December. Okay, this is using a gigantic supercomputer for a long time. Okay, and so that's what it really takes. And so our company supplies the really high performance interconnect that allows you to connect all of the computers together, all the GPUs together, or whatever your processing elements happen to be, to let them work together in a really efficient way to minimize the time it takes to converge the model, is really what we're trying to get the model to completely train and be ready for use.
Right. So basically Ethernet is generic, and you're talking about specific uses, so that'll be a much more efficient use of it. The place where we see quantum overlapping the most in AI, at least me as Cyprian's definitely the master of understanding this, but based on what I've seen, heard, speech seems to be one of the places where there's been a lot of noise. Bob Croak came on the show a couple times, talked about it. I think that's probably one of the biggest nexuses where we're going to need this processing power that you're providing in order to enable quantum and other technologies to kind of run rampant. And Cyprian, I'm sure you have thoughts on this.
Yeah, but what's interesting is that at the end of the day, and Philip mentioned the big transformer models, the GPT family, right? At the end of the day, these are huge neural nets. And one of the core tasks when training a neural net is solving what is essentially boils down to an optimization problem, right? So the interesting thing here is, what if in, let's say, the next decade or so, we gain the capability of solving those very large optimization problems, not in months, not even in weeks, right? But maybe in hours. That's where a quantum computing capability can be a game changer, right? And I'm not saying it's coming, right? It might not come, obviously, but I usually kind of propose these kind of exercise of imagination, right? We're all now like amazed by the capabilities of GPT and ChatGPT, right? One of the shortcomings, though, is if you ask ChatGPT about something that happened while the model was training, right, it has absolutely no knowledge. There's this blind spot of a few months, right? So what if we get the capability of training these models like within hours with the capabilities provided by quantum computers in terms of solving the optimization problems required to train the neural networks. Like, imagine what that would mean, right? Because it could go like two ways. You either have the capability of retraining the models significantly more often than you do right now, right? Or you could train like an order or two of magnitudes larger models than the ones that you have. And I'm not necessarily saying with more nodes, because that's an open discussion in the GPT world, right? But more complex models.
So this would be
something very interesting.
Are you saying that the task of training is an optimization model in it of itself, not that the training results in its ability to solve an optimization
It's not only an optimization problem, but one of the steps that you do, right? One of the core steps that you do when you train a neural network, right?
Is find the optimization path.
Is essentially optimizing the weights of the connections, whether you use traditional gradient descent approaches or derivatives of them or anything else. At the end of the day, it boils down to an optimization problem. You need to solve that optimization problem multiple times, right? Because like for our listeners, the way that you do, you've got the structure of the neural network, which is essentially a bunch of weights at the end of the day. Well, a bunch, so to speak, because with GPT-4, it's multiple billions of weights, but never mind, right? So the way you do it, you send the data through, right? And then you look at the outputs, you see how different they are from what you expect. And then you go back and change a little bit those weights. And then you do it again and again and again and again, right? Until those outputs are whatever you want to be, right? This process of changing the weights, this is the actual optimization problem. So it's a step in the whole thing. And I'm just like, I'm obviously like everyone on the planet today, I'm amazed by the capabilities of GPTs. Yeah. What if like we get the power to do it like an order or two of magnitude more complex? That would be like, I think, pose very interesting challenges.
Well, I mean, some of these are fantastical. I'm sorry, Phil. I definitely want to hear what you think about this because he's just blowing my mind as usual.
No, I'm fascinated by the conversation as well, right? Obviously coming from a more classical approach so far, given that we don't have, quantum computers yet. But I totally agree that, training a neural network is, in fact, an optimization problem. Certainly quantum computers can potentially solve, really complex optimization problems, faster than a classical computer by probably orders of magnitude. And that's a really exciting thing. And certainly machine learning, as you're mentioning, the gradient descent, kind of optimization problem for generating the weights on quantum computers, on large models. Quantum computers could absolutely accelerate that, dramatically, and then the training would be really, really quick. There's a race going on, though, right? Of course, others are, even right now, figuring out how to continue to make the algorithms better. Read that, one of the companies called Anthropic, right, is, they feel like they may have the algorithms more or less that they need. They may have the data more or less that they need, and they're looking to get 1,000x on the computation side in order to get to the next wave. Just to put all this in context, right? It's really fascinating to think about the waves of AI because I've been fascinated by this since the late 70s. Actually, there was a fantastic book that came out called Gödel, Escherbach, An Eternal Golden Braid. I don't know if you ever heard of it, but it was a guy, Douglas Hostetler, wrote it. And it's just kind of it was this really interesting book that kind of interweaved the stories of mathematics and art and literature and all that. But what it was really about was the foundations of human intelligence, consciousness, creativity, things like that. So I've been fascinated by AI for a long, long time, kind of watching its progress. And we go through phases, right, of excitement, and then what they call an AI winter, where the hype died out, and it all kind of faded away for a while. And I think the last AI winter ended probably around 2012, there was this there was this image recognition competition that happened every year. I see Supriya Shaky said, so he knows about this, right? You know, there's something called the ImageNet database, and people were trying to write C code to figure out what was in this image, right? And they would have been spending the rest of their lives, you know, trying to figure this out, or
trying before. To make a program think like a person. The way a person thinks.
Yeah, well, an image presented to a code is really just, a three-dimensional array of numbers, okay? You got to go figure out, is there a cat in that picture? I mean, good luck, okay? That would have been taking them forever. But they had competitions of people getting, you know, poor results, 10%, 20% success rate, things like that. And then somebody walked in with a neural network called AlexNet, okay, that was the first trained neural network that was trained to recognize images, and it blew the competition away, okay. And that was, 2012. That was the spark. We'll call it the deep learning wave, okay. That was the spark. That should have ended the last, AI winter. And then, everything was going great. We got a whole bunch of really interesting things happening, right? We had things like, protein folding, solutions coming out, from DeepMind. We had, recommendation systems for people like Netflix. We had something
winning Jeopardy.
that was before this revolution.
Oh, that's true.
I can't imagine if you put the latest stuff in Jeopardy, nobody would have a prayer. So that was the first wave. That was kind of the deep learning wave. And then, it seemed like that would go on for a while, but the second wave has already crashed on top of us, right? And that's the generative AI wave, okay? Where we have, these large language models. We also have, image generation and many other really interesting things going on. And that's just shocking, right, that's happening. That already required 100x to 1,000x, more computation to train these models, right? We're used to, 175 billion parameter weight, models. It's just amazing. But the third wave is right around the corner, okay? And that's going to be the cognitive AI wave, all right? Where, it's a little scary, right? Which is, what happens when these neural networks are better than almost everything than humans are, okay? What's going to happen to civilization? I don't know. I'm not worried about the Terminator, but I am worried about jobs. What are people going to do, and what's going to happen to our economy and things like that? Because it feels like it's coming, okay? And there are companies on the forefront already that think they know how to do that and how to get there. That's kind of how I see it. And so let's imagine that in 5 years, somebody like Anthropic does crack the code, or OpenAI does crack it, and we get there. Of course, it can have this spiraling up effect, right? If you can use the tool that you just developed to build a better tool, okay, then you can have this spiraling up effect of it creating the next neural network that's even better than the previous one. Okay, this is something that was predicted by a guy named Ray Kurzweil, if you know him, the singularities near. Okay, that was another book that was really important to me, right? It affected my thinking. And he had some predictions that said, we'd have, artificial general intelligence by 2029. And for a long time, I was watching to see if this really happened. And, for a while, it seemed like, well, he was too optimistic. And all of a sudden, he's too pessimistic, right?
So let me ask this question. So as the non-AI guy, but somebody who's, I actually considered getting my master's in AI, and I just couldn't afford the time. So maybe when I'm 70, I'll do that. In order for general AI to exist, it has to understand concepts that I don't know that anybody is working on. The way I explain it to most people is a specific AI can make you think it's smart, and it can do things that make it appear smart. But a general AI has to actually understand what the letter A is, means, and why we use it. And I don't know that, and it needs to understand a billion other things like that, that it can fool me into thinking it knows what it is, but I don't think it actually knows what it is in order to be general AI. Are you saying that we're almost there, or that it's more a specific AI that can act like a general AI without being one? In other words, I'm thinking about consciousness and the ability to have value judgments and biases and things like that.
Sure. Now, again, I'm going to, you know, preface this by saying, I'm not really an AI expert, right? I'm more of an interconnect guy, right? That's, you know, trying to make, build these super, you know, help these supercomputers come into fruition. But I'll tell you, I think that what you're talking about here is, you know, what Stoner called the AI grounding problem, right? You know, what, you know, if you're living in the real world, like a human being or a robot even, okay, where you can experience the real world, then you can kind of know what an apple is, you know, a lot more than from a symbolic representation from, you know, what you've read or the, you know, scoured from the internet. However, there's a lot of folks that disagree with that. Okay. And that, and there was just a paper that came out last week on that very topic of AI grounding. And can you really get AI grounding by, not knowledge grounding, I should say, by, it's just doing, image processing or language, you know, processing, text processing, things like that. And some folks are thinking, yes, right. It gets into wondering, you know, what is the brain really doing? Okay. Yes, it's an embodiment, but do you really need embodiment to, it's a body, but do you really need a body to get the grounding or not? So it's an open debate, I think, about whether you really need that. And getting into philosophy, maybe too much for today, but, it's really kind of interesting, you know, to think through, some of the aspects that you just brought up.
The interesting thing is we have, I believe, another frontier in front of us when we talk about these models, right? They are great. They are super powerful, but they are essentially transformers, at least today, right? And if you think about GPT-3 was trained on text, GPT-4 was trained on text and image, and rumors are saying that GPT-5 is going to be trained on text, image, and sound. So it will most likely also be able to speak. But the interesting thing here is that from a certain point of view, these transformer models are just like amazingly complex autocomplete engines, right? Because the way they are being trained. Now, the way I see it, when the frontier that will be crossed, and I'm sure it will be probably the next few years, is when we take the leap from transformer models to reinforcement learning models. Reinforcement learning essentially relies on neural networks, but it's the kind of process that we use today, for instance, to teach cars how to drive themselves or to teach robots how to perform extremely complicated tasks, right? So I believe that when we will start merging the capabilities of reinforcement learning with transformers and everything else that we have learned, right, it's going to be interesting. And Patrick and I are discussing often what the Shor algorithm did to quantum computing, right? Which in essence, it's the kind of guarantee that funding will never dry because of the effect, right? Now, I think that GPTs are doing today the same thing to AI, right? They are the thing that most likely will keep the money, the interest, the research flowing for at least a decade, if not more. So going back to the discussion about quantum computing, the things that you folks are doing in terms of improving the classical infrastructure, the interconnectivity, the even dedicated hardware. Like I have an easy time imagining that a few years from now, we will have super dedicated, super connected hardware to train machine learning models, right? So, and this is the bad news for the quantum guys, right? I'm not even sure that by the time quantum becomes a thing, right, it will be able to easily surpass the classical capabilities. So I think the question of quantum supremacy in this specific field of solving optimization problems for AI and machine learning is a totally open question because, like, we were used to think about Moore's law, like we double the speed of the processor, things like that, right? And then we went kind of horizontal. We created immense data centers and we keep creating them. But now we kind of move into the third dimension, which is integration, right? And that's where Philip, companies like yours and the others are creating like unbelievable progress, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that we are kicking it into high gear in terms of classical computing. And I would be curious to kind of hear your opinion about, are we like just pushing a known envelope here in terms of classical? Or do you think that like this field has a couple of interesting surprises in its sleeve, right? Left to be discovered, like, or let me put it otherwise. What do you feel or think is the potential of continuous improvement in the field of classical computing for these types of tasks, right? Are we kind of close to the limit? Is that something that we can push like for, I don't know, next 10, 20 years? How do you think like from being the in the inside of this whole process, like where do you see it kind of go in, say, 5, 10, 15 years from now?
Now, those are all great questions for sure, right, Sabrina? So just, you know, from a historical perspective, right, who could believe that we would have, you know, an exponential improvement in silicon technology for 5 decades? I mean, exponentials usually can't last anywhere near that long, right?
And so, Gordon Moore.
Yeah, no.
That's about it.
Absolutely amazing, for sure, right? And so, you know, the progress there has been, you know, undoubtedly just shocking. Okay. However, you know, in truth, you know, the important parts of Moore's Law to me ended around 2004, 2005, when we finally started getting the 2 to 3 gigahertz, you know, range on CPUs. And that ended up, you know, pausing it around that time frame. And, you know, the problem there is what they call, you know, the scaling at the transistor level would cause, you know, the temperatures to rise to, you know, the surface of the sun, basically, if you kept driving it. And so you can't do that, right? And so the only other solution then was to slow down on the frequency and start creating more and more cores, right?
Wouldn't that have helped fusion, though? I mean, that's another thing, right? We should be recommending. Sorry.
So instead of allowing an individual core to continue to improve in performance, which is a lot easier for the software, believe me, right? You don't have to worry about it. We ended up having to create many, many, many cores. And that's a programming problem for many applications because you have to be able to take an algorithm that was written for, you know, sequential processing and hope that you can parallelize it and distribute it across many, many cores. And of course, now you're adding a lot of overhead because you have to manage, you know, you have to coordinate the activities all of a sudden as well. That's where we do come in and help do that. So some applications you can do that. Turns out, fortunately, that AI training is one of those applications that is very parallelizable, right? Just create many copies of your model, distribute them all over this data center, send out the current parameters, let them run some epochs of training the data. You know, you are running through the data, let all the weights get, you know, resent to a central place, you know, recalculated, redistributed, and do this over and over again, right? So it is, in fact, you know, one of those parallelizable tasks. Now, the question you're asking is, well, you know, how much more progress can we make using traditional approaches, right? Because, you know, we hit the first wall, which is the frequency wall. And, you know, unless something, you know, crazy comes along that surpasses silicon in that world, and people are working on it, and it could happen, right? You know, graphene and things like that. But the odds, it's not, someday something will happen, but not in anytime soon. You know, then we had to stop going in the frequency dimension and start going into the more parallel dimension of adding more and more cores. Okay,
right.
We're getting into many, many cores at this point, and that's great. You know, where will the and of course the fundamental building blocks continue to improve, but we're shifting now from, I think, an era of, you know, just pure improvements in general processing to getting more and more specialized, right? So companies like Google, you know, I'm sure you know, I did things like TensorFlow processors, okay, or specific implementations to try to advance, you know, the processing of AI. Many of the startup companies are also doing the same kind of thing, analyzing details of the specific requirements for the training, and then, you know, building hardware to do that, right? And then that's going to eventually come to an end as well, you know, maybe not that far into the future. I think that's where, you know, something like quantum could come in. And, you know, I think of quantum, you know, in the early days, I personally think it's still, you know, maybe many years away because there's still significant problems to solve, you know, no doubt about it, you know, quantum error handling, You know, things like
parallelization being one of those.
Yeah.
And interconnects.
Right. And so, you know, we think of this as, you know, in, you know, when it is ready, I think it's going to end up being early on sort of treated like an accelerator would be treated in a supercomputer. It'll be attached to a supercomputer.
Yep.
Maybe, you know, it'll be like the vacuum tube days of computers on day one, where it's a very big machine or expensive machine requiring, you know, absolute zero cooling and things like that. And so it'll be, it'll be an accelerator connected to a supercomputer through a high performance interconnect. Okay. Now, of course, you know, maybe just like you know, we went from the vacuum tube, you know, filling up a room type of computer to your cell phone, which is, you know, 100 times, probably a million times more powerful, right? We may get that evolution in quantum as well. Okay. But, you know, in the early days, I'm thinking about, you know, when it's first emerging, I think it's going to be very complementary to the supercomputer. I don't think it's going to be great for everything. As you mentioned, it's going to be great for, you know, optimization problems for sure. And I do think that, you know, when it does come to fruition, it's going to outperform classical computers by orders of magnitude on optimization problems. So it'll be perfect for connecting to supercomputers, and then let the supercomputer traditional processing do what it's good at, let the quantum computer do what it's good at. And of course, our job as Cornelis Networks will be to make sure that we can interface getting the data in and out very rapidly between.
It's kind of like the GPU is a specialized unit that does something very well. Quantum will be the same. Maybe you'll send the multiple calculations to the GPUs, and then when you have an optimization, it'll go off to a quantum in a local array and come back, and it's another component of it. And so it's an enabler for the mountains that we still haven't even seen yet. But I agree with you. It's not scaling yet to be able to add that value.
It's kind of commonly accepted today that quantum is not replacing classical,
right?
And it's not even like,
competing.
I honestly, we've been doing this podcast for more than 2 years now. We haven't had one single guest coming in and saying, you know, I'm a believer in replacement. Quantum computing will replace, right? It's not going to happen. We will not run quantum databases. We will not run intense data processing on quantum computers, because that's not how they are built. That's not what they do. So hybrid, I believe, is going to be the name of the game, even if, and that's still an if, I think, Philip, you kind of hit the nail on the head. If those things become stable enough, I'm talking about quantum computers, right? But I think that the interesting challenge there, and this is something that we see quite a lot today already, is exactly that interconnect, right? When we figure out, okay, how do we connect the classical code to the quantum code? How do we connect those two wildly different computing paradigms in a way that the connection itself would not break the efficiency of the process? Because that's an open discussion as well. Right. So I think the future holds like several interesting challenges, because even if we get that magical quantum computer that is able, say, to solve the GPT-5, say, optimization problem required to train, but we don't have the capability of moving, or let's say embedding the problem from the classical neural network training into the quantum computer, and then getting the results out,
right,
that magical quantum computer will just sit there,
yep,
right? And we will look at it and we will say, amazing, this is so powerful, right? It has no practical use.
It becomes performance art.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, look, I think that, you know, there's strong consensus that that quantum computers, when they are available, they're going to be great for optimization problems. They're going to be great for cryptography. I believe that they're going to be great for machine learning, okay, and all that. And of course, you know,
material science.
Yeah, material science. You know, quantum simulations. Right? What better to, you know, simulate a quantum process than a quantum computer? Right? It's probably not going to be great, at least in the short run, for general computing. You know, general purpose computing or graphics and video, things like that. As you mentioned, you know, databases or large scale data storage and retrieval. you know, things like that. It doesn't seem to have the potential in the short term. But yeah, I don't want to undersell it either, because, you know, I think when the PC first came out, people said, oh, it'd be great to hold, you know, your recipes or something, you know, I mean, so, you know, people do figure these things out over time. So this is just where we are in our thinking today.
I think you're saying it's not going to be better than what we already have. Well, so, we already have a good enough mousetrap.
Yeah, we don't know right now what all the uses are going to be. And so we have certain perspectives today on what we know it should be good at, and things that are harder to see. But, you know, time changes people's opinions is all I'm saying, right? I'm just saying when IBM came out with the PC, they were like, hey, you know, here's my advertising for it. You know, you can store your recipes on it. Okay. Well, guess what? We do a lot more with that right now. Okay. So, you know, that may happen with Quantum as well. But again, you know, we're just talking about our current day, you know, perspectives on what it's going to be great at. But the important one, I think, is the machine learning one to me. Okay. Where, you know, if you really could, as you said, you know, train, you know, GPT-5 or something from Anthropic in days or weeks instead of a month or a year that it might take, many months or a year that it might take now, that would be, you know, a huge improvement. But if it takes 10 years to get there, the world's not going to look anything like it looks today in 10 years. Okay. The progress on traditional computing is so rapid, you know, in this specific area. And of course, this is where all the money's going to flow now, because it's really civilization transforming. So how could it be different? Okay. Mm. And so, yeah, I'm really excited, a little worried, about what's happening.
Aren't we all?
Well, do you think that things like the CHIPS Act and the fact that everything's based on open source, or seems to be based on open source, are steps in the right direction?
Yeah, they are.
Well, just let me interject there. It's not really open source, Patrick. Just to be clear, to give you an example, OpenAI hasn't published yet.
But it's based on open source data.
The internal, well, data, yes, but hasn't published yet the internal specifications of GPT-4. Okay. So we don't really know what the internal structure is. And I'm not inferring here or implying that there is something evil in that or whatever, right? It's just that it's not public knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, no, OpenAI, I think, has gotten, you know, pretty close with Microsoft. I think everybody knows that, and with Azure processing, you know,
cloud.
Right, they're not as forthcoming. And there could be a lot of reasons for that, including, you know, the dangers that are associated with
Exactly.
They may well be.
And honestly, given the track record of Microsoft with responsible AI, I kind of feel okay with this because Microsoft was one of the companies, if we look back like a few years ago, Microsoft was the company that refused to publish their most powerful text-to-speech machine learning model just to make sure that they kind of do not provide the perfect tool for deepfakes and things like that.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah.
They've got an eye towards that.
There's a question in my mind, Philip. I really wanted to make sure that you get to answer in the show. Like, what is or are the next big things that you folks are like trying to solve in the space that you kind of push things forward? Like, what is that thing that is now, like, let's say, state of the art, or the one that you are looking to solve? Like, what is the next big step for you in terms of the capabilities that you are building? I would really like to hear from you a little bit on that. Of course, the extent that you can publicly speak about it, of course.
No, look, so it's really exciting. You know, our history here is, you know, I did a startup company back in the year 2000. You know, I'd spent many years in the mainframe world, and I did a startup in the year 2000, focused on high-performance interconnects, specifically for parallel computing. There was a new standard that was just evolving at that time called InfiniBand, okay, which was a sort of a complementary to Ethernet that was, you know, much, much higher performance and all that. And so I built my first company, and actually we sold that to QLogic Corporation. We had some really great success at QLogic, and then Intel actually brought us in to continue the development. They also brought a team in from Cray that was working on very similar technologies, and they brought that technology into it as well. And we had the opportunity to kind of have a do-over. We had a second chance at building a very high-performance interconnect, now learning everything that was good and bad about InfiniBand, and also learning about, you know, the kind of amazing technological leaps that Cray had made in this environment. And we created our own technology called OmniPath there that was really specifically focused on improving the performance of AI and high-performance computing, supercomputers. You know, Intel decided to let us take it back out in the year 2020, in September of that year, okay? And so now what we've been focused on is advancing that technology, right? In this new world, we did a lot of work, you know, pulling the AI community and pulling the high-performance supercomputing community to make sure that we knew what their applications were going to need in terms of coordinating all the activities that we talked about, as well as, you know, the specific features that they needed for seamless integration into their next-generation solutions. And so, you know, that's what we're focused on. And, you know, what happens here is that, you know, there's a whole ecosystem of partners that are, you know, some are processor partners that are coming out with, you know, general purpose processors. Others are very specifically coming out with accelerators. Okay, we need to understand what they're all doing so that we can help them integrate into the next generation superstructures that are needed for processing, mostly AI and performance computing. If that makes sense.
Sounds like you're a key part of that ecosystem that we all have a vested interest in being successful. So,
yeah, we kind of consider ourselves the essential enabler of it. You know, think of us as sort of the foundation. If you lay the foundation, which is this high performance interconnect that lets everything communicate, and then you plug into it the things that are going to help you in your, you know, your processing elements, they're going to actually process the information in the.
Cool. So time flies when you're having an interesting conversation. We're kind of coming up against it, but we get enough time if there's something else you'd like to bring up or point out to us.
No, I think, you know, the only thing you mentioned was the CHIPS Act. And I would just say that, you know, the CHIPS Act, I think, is really important. We're trying to, you know, bring back mostly chip fabrication into the U.S. So we don't do that. We're a fabulous semiconductor company, but we do, I mean, we do our own chips, but we don't obviously fab them ourselves. But I do think part of the CHIPS Act is also encourage domestic development of ASICs as well. And we do that. And so, you know, we're tracking that very, really closely. We do think it's important because, you know, I'm a little worried, as I said a couple of times, about AI. And, you know, there could be almost a winner take all situation here. If you're the first one to get to very powerful AI and you have it, you know, use it as a tool to build the next one, you could start to lap the competition pretty quickly. Okay. And I don't really want to see that happen if we're not on the forefront of that.
We want a democracy to do that. Let's just say it outright. We want a democracy to do that, not a dictatorship. So I'm on the same page. Well, thank you very much, Phil. It was great talking to you. And, you know, I'm sure we'll be watching you if we see you at one of these conferences. I'm sure you and Cyprian will probably be going to the same conferences. We hope we can take you out for a drink or something.
Pleasure, guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
See y'all later.